von A bis Holz.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von A bis Holz, dem Podcast von Proholz Austria. Mein Name ist Anne Isop. Längst werden in Europa nicht mehr nur einzelne Gebäude, sondern ganze Quartiere aus Holz gebaut. Man denke zum Beispiel an die ökologische Mustersiedlung in München. Holzbau in so großen Dimensionen überhaupt zu denken, war vor ein paar Jahren eigentlich noch undenkbar. Um uns wieder in Erinnerung zu rufen, wie rasch der moderne Holzbau sich in den letzten Jahrzehnten entwickelt hat, müssen wir nur gedanklich 2 Jahrzehnte zurückgehen. In London wurde 2008 der erste 9-geschossige Wohnbau in Holzbauweise errichtet. Der Name des Wohnbaus ist Murray Grove. Für die Entwicklung des Holzbaus, nicht nur in England, sondern auch bei uns, war dieser Bau wegweisend. Die Architekten von Murray Grove heißen Boss Sisselton und sind Pioniere des modernen Holzbaus. Doch wie viel wird eigentlich heute noch in London aus Holz gebaut? Um darauf eine Antwort zu finden, reisen wir in dieser Folge gedanklich nach London und hören, was Architekt Andrew Waugh von Waugh Sisselton dazu zu sagen hat. Das Gespräch führt Mike Nowotny. Er ist Architekturjournalist aus Wien und regelmäßiger Autor unserer Zeitschrift Zuschnitt. Das Gespräch findet auf Englisch statt.
Andrew, when we think of architecture in the UK, seen from the outside, from our continental perspective, we mostly think of high-tech architecture, postmodern architecture, and in terms of material, we think mainly of brick architecture, not necessarily about wood and timber construction. So maybe you can start explaining how you and timber came together. What's the origin story?
No, you're absolutely right. London, the UK, is country dominated by brick facades, you know, and that's what you're trained in. But I think for us, a kind of a move away from that masonry form of architecture really started not so much around sustainability, but more around prefabrication and thinking about more modern ways of constructing, of designing buildings, more contemporary ways, rather than having some poor person on a building site trying to put one lump of dried out clay on top of another lump of dried out clay. It all felt a little bit kind of, you know, old fashioned, time to move on. And then the more that we began to understand about the advantages of prefabrication, about of a more lightweight construction, then the more we understood about the sustainability, about the kind of climate issues caused by carbon intensive materials such as concrete and brick and steel. So we are very much of a tradition of masonry and steel in the UK, but I think moving towards a greener future, a kind of, you know, a future which acknowledges the impact of construction on the environment, that talks about where our building materials come from, is a really important part of the architectural conversation. You referred earlier to high tech. I think that's a really interesting example of actually how architecture can shine. You know, how architecture can really talk about contemporary issues, both aesthetic and cultural issues. And I think that sort of understanding of architecture's place beyond the functional is really important and something that we think about a lot as a practice.
In terms of milestones, I think the Dawson Works project was rather a big milestone, completed in 2017 in London. At the time, the world's largest CLT building, cross-laminated timber, and in a high-density environment. So in what way did that pave the way for constructions in a scale like this? Was it like a platform project for your office, also like a landmark project for the UK in general or London?
Yeah, definitely. I think that it was a landmark project in many contexts. It was, you know, it's 10 stories and what is it, 18,000, 19,000 square meters, big building, and lots of people live there. When we speak to them, they're happy and they like their homes and they talk about the fantastic acoustic separation and how they're really proud to live in a kind of low carbon building. And they talk about their very low heating bills and how it doesn't get hot in the summer, etc. So, you know, really great result. And I think in terms of influence for us as a practice, incredibly important milestone to demonstrate the achievement or the possibility of that type of building at scale. And that timber had the opportunity to be a viable replacement for concrete and steel, I think was really important to us and hopefully to others. I think in terms of a milestone, I would have said probably Murray Grove was even more important to us as a practice in 2008, because that was the first kind of test case of thinking about mass timber as, you know, as a viable construction material for urban housing and the first tall building in the world in mass timber. And I think that that made a real difference. And for us, that gave us, I think, a real sort of confidence as a practice that this was a really important kind of step in architecture.
So if we switch to that project, which is also really interesting, Murray Grove in 2008, 2009, what actually made that possible? Was there some kind of special framework, or was it more your initiative as architects to say, no, we want to go in this direction?
It was a number of different things. We had built our first CLT building in 2003, 2002. We built another couple of small ones after that. But we had been thinking about what the opportunities might be to use this material at scale. And we've been working with an engineer friend of ours, Matthew Wells, with KLH, the manufacturers of the CLT for Murray Grove and for other projects that we'd worked on, with Karl-Heinz Weiss there. And really, with those two, had begun to explore the idea of building at scale in mass timber. So beyond the kind of smaller buildings that were more prevalent in the rest of Europe, thinking actually about how we can begin to reduce the embodied carbon of construction in cities by looking at alternative materials, and that cross-laminated timber, all forms of mass timber really, but specifically cross-laminated timber at that time, was the first material that we had come across that was both low carbon, replenishable, and you could build at scale and at height. And so it was just one of those really, like in all kind of, I guess, situations of innovation, it takes a coincidence of lots of different events, right? So our client happened to be trained as an architect. So we piqued his interest with this. And then it was also when the UK, when London was building the Olympics for 2012. You know, 2008 was the height of that, and concrete and reinforcement steel were very expensive. And, you know, there was a waiting list. And so I guess our client was prepared to engage in an idea that maybe at another time they might not have been so readily willing to think about.
So when we look at the coming back to the Dawson Works project, which was, as we discussed, also milestone, but if you look at it, the facade is actually not wood, but brick.
So yeah.
I was wondering, how did that happen? Was it like the plan from the start?
No, it was not the plan from the start at all. And in many ways, it's completely counterintuitive, because obviously, the brick can only support itself for a couple of stories. So every story above, you know, 7 or 8 stories above, is supported by steel angle brackets bolted into the timber, which then support the brickwork. And so that means that we had to increase the amount of timber on the building by about 10% just to hold the brick up in the air and to give the building an impression of solidity and give the building an impression of being a brick building. Certainly was not the kind of truth to detail that we were looking for as a practice, you know, truth to material that we were looking for as a practice, rather. So, no, that was one of those situations, you know, where the client and I were sat with the local planning authority in the borough hall, and the planner said, oh, it's a shame you can't do it in brick. My client said, that's exactly what I was thinking. And I was kind of maneuvered into a sort of situation where it was very difficult to do anything else. A lot of the local context is obviously brick. And so doing something outside of that context was challenging. And, you know, for me at the time, the kind of the most important factor in that context was about building this building at scale in timber. And so actually, you know, the fact that it's in brick, not what I would have chosen, but also not let that get in the way of the achievement that that building was.
So you were outnumbered in that case in the discussion.
Yeah,
still, there's still lots of timber inside.
There's an awful lot of timber in that building. And, you know, in a similar way to Murray Grove, we had a great client on that building. And it also sits above the Eurostar tunnel. So the lightweight nature of the material, the fact that we designed the building in such a way that we really reduced the need for any kind of piled foundation. So that enabled the building to be built much taller in timber than it could have been in concrete. So I think it could have been something like four or five stories in concrete, and we could double the height of that in timber.
You mentioned before, it's a special approach of designing and constructing with wood. It's not like a concrete building, but with timber, but it has its own rules. I always find it quite interesting to talk like architects who are specializing in these constructions, that if you construct and design in wood, it has certain restrictions, it has its own rules, but it has also
opportunities
and liberties.
Absolutely.
Maybe you can talk about your approach with that. I mean, you can't just make a wild blob architecture. It has to have some kind of rectangularity.
Yeah, still, absolutely.
You can do it.
I think the thing is that, you know, it does, but I think that actually all buildings probably should be more restrained in their form than we have been looking at for some decades. And I think there are a few reasons behind that. One is that it takes a lot of construction materials to make a kind of non-orthogonal building. It takes a lot more stuff to make a building that might be a bizarre shape. And we don't live in an era where we have access to more stuff. In fact, we should be using less stuff for everything. So that whole kind of notion around sufficiency really drives us to simplicity in terms of built form. Now, timber responds to that really well. Timber makes simple building forms very, very well, very efficiently. It's incredibly strong for its weight, so it can support incredible masses. It moves well in seismic conditions. It's got great insulation properties, acoustic and thermal. So all these things it can work really well at within the environment that we need to employ it.
You mentioned also the environmental aspects and efficiency and the reduction of carbon emissions. So I was wondering, where actually does the wood for your CLT construction come from? I know you're also like calculating and monitoring the gray energy of transport and sourcing of materials.
So we monitor that very carefully. Actually, the impact of transportation is really pretty small. It's really pretty minor, especially when you think about the amount of steel that we're bringing in from Turkey or Mexico or the US or Russia or whatever, you know, especially when you're thinking about the amount of sand that's being taken out of the North Sea or, you know, the environmental degradation that's being done in kind of sand mining and, you know, or from the Indian subcontinent. I think that it's always really important to think about not only what demands you make of your own, you know, of your own work, but also thinking about what the alternative pathway would do as well. And so, yes, it would be much better to be able to source more timber from the UK. We can't do that because we burn it. We burn 2/3 of our timber or so. So for biomass, because that's counted as a renewable energy source, ridiculously. So in the UK, it's still as profitable to burn timber as it is to build with it. We have to buy our timber from Austria and Germany and Sweden and Spain. But they're not very far away, really. I'm a European, first and foremost. So for me, the fact that I buy, you know, if I'm buying timber from Salzburg, it gets here faster than timber from Scotland, from the north of Scotland. So actually, where's the difference?
Yeah, the only difference is Brexit. Does it have any influence?
Yeah, sure it does. It's incredibly depressing, embarrassing, and absolute failure on behalf of our politicians.
Yeah, it's maybe moving back to like colleagues, and also like I was interested in the framework for building in timber in the UK, maybe starting also with the building industry. Like the building industry in the UK doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't have like the reputation of being very precise on site. It's lots of unskilled labor and the quality of craftsmanship is sometimes a bit shoddy. So
it's terrible.
How do you deal with that if you need precision? It does prefabrication help because you shift it off the site?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We have real quality issue in our construction market in the UK. We have had for decades, and it's a very wasteful industry. It's very expensive to build in the UK and it's low quality. So the construction market in the UK, the construction industry needs phenomenal change, and pre-site manufacture of elements of construction is definitely a way to enhance quality in our buildings. And that actually was the original driver for us and why we started looking at mass timber way back, you know, 20 odd years ago, was in order to try and obtain that quality in construction.
Are there new like players on the market, like smaller companies who are specializing that you can rely on, or you're building some kind of network, or is there some kind of lobbying network for timber construction, or are you still like single pioneers out there?
It's pretty difficult here. I mean, we work, about half our work is outside the UK. The UK does not have the same kind of legislation or government policy around decarbonizing construction as other countries in Europe have. One thing that Brexit unfortunately did do for us was allowed us to kind of slow down on lots of the kind of ambition that previously existed in our construction industry. So that's difficult. We obviously had Grenfell, which was an awful, appalling event caused by our construction industry and the kind of misplaced values of the construction industry. It has also, I think, caused the entire industry to look very carefully at the quality of the buildings that we design and build. And so obviously timber was going to come under the same microscope. timber is an easy thing to criticize in that kind of culture because obviously it's combustible. So how can we put in the safety checks and the kind of proper kind of process for ensuring safety from timber buildings and timber and construction? So actually that's something that we've learned to do in the last 5 years, and that we have really began to understand that whereas maybe several years ago we were building timber buildings without the same level of investigation, without the same level of sort of integration with the contractor that we are now. So I think we're doing a much better job now. You know, we try to ensure and enhance the quality of what we're designing and constructing year in, year out. And I think that the Grenfell tragedy has encouraged the whole industry in the UK to improve, you know, which is an ongoing process.
So the Grenfell Tower, which burned in 2017, where there was no timber wood construction involved, but did that still make it more difficult because everyone was going, so it was becoming nervous?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was no timber in the building. In fact, the only timber in the building was in the fire doors, and the fire doors, you know, where they were used properly, they worked, right? But if Grenfell had have been a timber building with a flammable facade, if it had been a timber building where there had been a fire in an apartment with improper use of fire doors in other, you know, throughout the building, then it would have been a greater tragedy than it was in concrete. Okay, so it wasn't, the concrete didn't not self-combust or self-combust, and the timber wouldn't have self-combusted either. But, you know, the fact that we had a flammable facade and a poorly detailed and a poorly constructed building with nobody taking responsibility for either the design or the brief or the construction of that building, it would have been a worse event if it had been made of timber. And I think that that's something that we need to sort of acknowledge. The benefits of building in timber are so massive, are so obvious and apparent and desperately required by our industry that we do the material a disservice if we don't also acknowledge where we need to pay special attention to it. You know, so yes, it can go rotten and yes, it can burn, but we also have the understanding and the opportunity, the technology to be able to mitigate all of those disadvantages of the material to such an extent that we can produce buildings at safe buildings at scale, but they need to be built well and built carefully. But then all buildings should be built well and built carefully.
So while we're moving to the dry but very important subject of building regulations in terms of timber construction, were there any developments or breakthroughs in terms of building codes or fire precautions that allowed more freedom?
No.
Or less freedom?
So I think that, I mean, unfortunately, what has happened in the UK is that because people have been very slow to make meaningful policy change in construction post-Grenfell, that actually a very fast and easy way of demonstrating to the public that the industry is changing is by applying simplistic kind of overlays on existing construction regulations, on existing building code. So we've had a few years ago, the Mayor of London saying that they won't give any funding for buildings with timber on the outside of them, which is, you know, frustrating because actually all the reports on Grenfell said that there was nothing wrong with our building code. It was just how the building code was being overseen and operated that was the problem. And so we haven't really yet had fundamental changes in that, although they're coming. We've just had meaningless changes to the building code. So that's frustrating, but we're working on it. We're working with different policy makers in the UK, with different government officials in the UK, and certainly there's an enthusiasm to reinvigorate timber construction in the UK at the moment that we haven't seen in several years. So that's exciting. So things are definitely getting better here. But, you know, the timber industry in the UK, or the mass timber industry in the UK, has really shrunk massively in the last 7 years or so.
Looking ahead, or looking at what you're doing now, are there any like new milestones in your projects coming up, or some larger projects which you really would say that sort of is a new step in the application of timber?
So I think that every project that we do has an aspect of innovation to it. You know, that's something that's core to our practice in architecture, core to the way in which we approach our building design. I think that the buildings that we're looking at the moment, we're really focused on the health and well-being aspects of those buildings, very focused on how we can passively design those buildings in order to have clear glass thinking about long-term adaptability of those buildings, the reuse of those construction materials is a really important part of what we're looking at. And also looking at system design, looking at how we can begin to design processes of construction, processes of design, which can arrive at completely different forms of architecture, but are beginning to get a better understanding of how you think about a timber building from first principles through to the construction of that building. A lot of that combined with the research that we're doing in practice about cultural understanding of timber buildings. You're talking about the differences, the variances of buildings across Austria. I think it's fascinating to see how vernaculars can be affected by slightly different environmental changes, material changes, changes in agriculture or, you know, or climate. And so how influences have affected different vernaculars regionally is something that we're very interested in as well as a practice, and how we can begin to employ those within a contemporary architecture. That's a kind of fascinating part of architecture, that this kind of ongoing journey of discovery.
And it also keeps you busy, like you also, because you provide the work for yourself. Well, yeah.
No, true. That's absolutely right. I don't know what I would do if I wasn't busy.
Well, that's a nice final word, actually.
Vielen Dank für das Gespräch und fürs Zuhören. Wir haben es gehört. Nach Mural Grove und Dolson Lane gab es kaum mehr weitere Entwicklungen in Holzbauweise in London. Erst kam die Finanzkrise 2008, dann kam Brexit und dann das Unglück mit dem Grenfell Tower. Außerdem, so sagte Bones im Nachhinein noch, dass England nicht die Nachhaltigkeitspolitik hat wie viele andere europäische Länder und doch glaubt er an den Holzbau. Und deswegen möchte ich ihn zum Abschluss hier noch einmal zitieren. Er sagt, ich denke, es ist unvermeidlich, dass die meisten unserer Städte und Gemeinden in Zukunft hauptsächlich aus Holz gebaut werden. Schauen Sie auch in die aktuelle Ausgabe der Zeitschrift Zuschnitt. Hier finden Sie kleine und große Quartiere aus Holz. Wer die Zeitschrift Zuschnitt noch nicht abonniert hat, kann dies gleich über den Link in den Shownotes tun. Liebe Zuhörer und Zuhörerinnen, vielen Dank für Ihr Interesse und fürs Zuhören. Bis zum nächsten Mal bei Von A bis Holz, dem Podcast von ProHolz Austria.